Welcome to the Health Design Podcast. Here's your host, Moyez Jiwa.
Samira Daswani was diagnosed with early breast cancer. But even before then, she had a keen interest in all things healthcare. In this podcast, she talks about the impact of that cancer on the trajectory of her career and her thinking around how healthcare's biggest problems can now be addressed. Here to tell her story is Samira Daswani. Samira, you're very welcome to this call. I'm delighted that we had an opportunity to connect on the Health Design Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you've had a very eclectic journey in healthcare, so I want to start there. What brought you to healthcare? What brought healthcare to your attention in the course of the last few years?
I started out my career as a bioengineer. Came to the U.S. I grew up in India, came to the U.S. for undergraduate education, and then ended up in consulting. I was at McKinsey & Company for a handful of years out of New York City, and then switched to startups. So I spent my professional career in the world of digital health. Had the opportunity to work in companies that were in oncology, companies that were in the patient information space, medical diagnostics. And that's when I got diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. This was back in 2020. And a lot of the work I do today does stem from my own lived experience as a patient, having gone through it, and to be completely honest, gotten really frustrated with the patient experience. So that solidified my desire to stay in the healthcare field.
You use the word frustrated by healthcare, and I want to try and understand this. What do you mean by frustrated? What were the experiences that were most upsetting for you?
I can start with probably the most seminal one for me. In one of the companies I was at previously, we had built a patient-reported outcomes tool for oncology patients, and that's been used at a large academic medical center in the U.S. So I was familiar with the research around symptom management, patient-reported outcomes, and the importance of tracking your symptoms as a patient. And I was also familiar with, from a different experience, with rough prognosis in early-stage breast cancer. So early-stage breast cancer, we really are in a world where we're looking predominantly at curative diseases. We're no longer living in a world where early stage breast cancer is really truly going to kill you. Yes, it happens, but it's unusual. So I knew that. So I think as a patient, I didn't go through the archetypical journey that I know other patients have gone through, which is I will die from this disease. I didn't have that. But because of my experiences in healthcare, I had basic expectations of what I would have hoped what the system would do given the knowledge we have, right? We know symptom tracking is important. We know that it changes outcomes. We know that to enhance quality of life, you have to enable shared decision-making. Like we know these things. So when I started my treatment, I got very frustrated because I didn't see any of that happen. And I wasn't at a community setting. I was at an academic medical center, a very well-known academic medical center. The oncologists were phenomenal, incredibly well-intentioned. The nurses were truly doing what I've heard people frame as God's work. And I think that's absolutely true from my experiences. So on the individual level, people were just phenomenal. But when you look at the experience in aggregate, it was a nightmare. I mean, ISQ educated, ISQ privileged. I understand healthcare. I have worked in healthcare. I know how to manage the system. And yet it was really difficult. And it wasn't just that was one thing that was difficult. There was a lot of things that were difficult. Everything from appointment scheduling, symptom tracking, communicating with your care team, understanding where the pivotal points are in the experience, making decisions. I mean, I can keep going. There was a lot. So I think for me, I essentially started documenting my experiences, ways to regain agency and control for myself as a patient. And I think that's where a lot of the work we do today comes from.
I want to explore this a little bit more because as a clinician, I find that really worrying. As a clinician doing, as you put it, God's work, people come to this job really well-meaning, wanting to do the job that they're trained to do in medical school, and yet they work within a system that doesn't appear to meet the expectations of patients. Where is that disconnect? What hope is there for clinicians of the future thinking about going into a system that essentially is not fit for purpose?
Maybe I can start with one thread in there, right? Because the question you asked me is, it has multiple facets to it. And maybe the thread I'm going to pick on is decision-making and information gathering. I say that because I think we are living in a world where patients of 2023 look and feel different than patients from 10 years ago. We are in a world where, at least in the US, you get on average 22 minutes with an oncologist. So no matter what you do as an oncologist, no matter how incredible as a person you are, how succinct you are, there's a lot that happens in those 20 minutes. From an oncologist perspective, I would imagine that they need to get the latest update from the patient's side from the last time they saw them. They have to do medication reconciliation. They need to get the biggest symptoms that have happened since the last visit. They need to change dosing of a drug or change the drug itself. They need to communicate to the patient what the next decision plan is going to be. So in that 20 plus minutes, there's a lot that's happened. And all of the focus has been on the clinician. The part that I think has completely missed is, what about the patient? The patients are no longer showing up in these appointments as deer in headlights always. They are doing research. They are using Google. They are using ChatGPT. They are absolutely seeking information, partly because the system doesn't give you enough information, and partly because the information that is given to you isn't contextualized to your use case. So for all of those reasons, I was at ASCO this year, and Dr. Mark Lewis showed data that said 97% of oncology patients and families are using Google. And if you look at the demographics of cancer, we're talking above 70. So we're talking, regardless of demographics of the patient population, there are information seekers out there that are consistently seeking information, right? But we are living in a world where there are no tools. The part that struck me, and it took me, honestly, I think it took me 2 years to realize why I was so upset, is, I mean, I work in healthcare. If you think about, let's just take this recording. In terms of this recording, look at the number of tools we have, right? There's Skype, there was an information prep, there was email, there was a PDF form, there was Samira, here's a prep you should do, here's the questions you should be thinking about, here's how we'll record, there was an appointment reminder. That's just for a podcast. And if I think about the patient experience, I don't have any tools. I have the patient portal, which I do not think meets even basic table stakes of the digital age we live in. So if we look at patient-facing tools, there basically are none. And for me, that becomes where there's a huge gap in our understanding of the experience, because we all focus on what should the system do versus let's focus on the patient. Let's give them tools that they can use that are designed for them to be better patients.
You talked about the experience of making an appointment in any other context. In any other context, you're asked how to prepare, what to expect, what are the likely outcomes of this experience that you're about to embark on. The problem, perhaps, is that healthcare is a business or frames itself as a business. And as a business, therefore, that 22 minutes is regarded as sacred. And so what people don't want is for that to blow out and say, well, patient will come along with a whole bunch of other things that may or may not be relevant in the case of oncology, a very super specialist area. And you're nodding, but I'm sure you've thought about this. Given that that is the case, how do we prepare patients for those meetings without blowing most precious commodity, which is the time that's available?
I am so glad that you framed it that way, because I think that therein lies, I think, the biggest dissonance I see in the system. So in any other business, all systems are designed for the end consumer. In healthcare, the end consumer is the patient. So if I think about healthcare as a business, that's the core frustration, right? Because at the end of the day, I, patient, I'm actually paying both in time and in dollars to receive care. And the care I receive is actually not in line with my preferences or in line with my goals, nor is it in line with what I believe to be the best care for me. Because we are constraining clinicians today by saying you have to practice a certain way. You have to practice a certain way by clinical guidelines, which makes sense because you need evidence, but also practice within a certain time constraint that has been imposed by not the patient. So if we think about healthcare as a business, it really does come back to who is the end consumer of the business. And for me, it is the patient. And yet we don't have any system or tools designed for that end consumer.
The Health Design Podcast is hosted by the Journal of Health Design, an alliance with Unfixed Media and Metal Health.
I want to challenge you a little bit and say, in fact, it isn't the patient who is the payer, it is the insurer. And often the insurer is only interested in some things, and the insurer is interested in exactly what services are going to be provided at the cost to that insurance to keep those premiums down. And often that means rationing. And when it comes to rationing, no better way to ration something than say, there's no time to deal with this issue.
I actually don't see that as a challenge at all. I see it as the complexity of the US healthcare system, because the contract is between me, the patient, and the insurer as well. It's not that the contract is happening between the provider and the insurance companies, and I as a patient, I'm not in the loop. Contract is actually happening between me and the insurance company. So when we talk about who is the ultimate payer, it's not that the insurance company is the only payer. In fact, if we look at the last decade, we have started to see the cost shift more and more to the patient's pocket, because we've seen the preponderance of high deductible plans. We've seen a preponderance of plans where the premiums have skyrocketed. I think it's true. I do think, of course, insurance companies are incentivized, but I think it's because they're incentivized the way they're incentivized that we have a lot of the problems we have. And I think it comes down to the insurance company realizing and the provider system realizing that the share of cost is no longer just the insurance company. And I think in certain states, and this is where it gets really complicated, but in certain states, if you're in a commercial setting, you actually do have some choice in picking a certain plan versus another plan. Like, let's just take California, right? There's absolutely choice under Medi-Cal where I can choose Kaiser, I can choose Blue Cross Blue Shield, I can choose United, and I do have some choice. Now, the question comes down to, am I as a consumer given the requisite information or education to make an informed choice? And I think that's where all the wheels of the wagon fall off the cart, right? Like, they really, it's just not designed for that. But if I were an informed consumer, there is choice today. And I think that choice is going to keep increasing, because I think the share of cost is continuing to move to the patient. And the more the share falls into my pocket as a consumer, the more I'm going to care about where I get care, who I get care from, and whether or not the care is meeting my bar.
Thank you. I would agree. And I would also agree that this is not just true in the US, but true elsewhere around the world. Out-of-pocket expenses are now a major feature of the healthcare system. And therefore, healthcare does have to respond in a way that respects, and I hate using the word customer, because I have philosophically a problem with people in pain having to pay to have that pain taken away. But that's a separate issue, I suspect. Now, having said that, I suspect the drivers for this change are going to be exponentially increased. You talk about Google, but Google is nowhere compared to ChatGPT and ChatGPT-4 and some of these other things that are going to give you detailed information. If you ask them, what is the best plan for me in these circumstances, it's going to spit out something that's going to be on point.
I think you're right. I think even if you look at the community in the last 6 months, I work with a lot of patients, and ChatGPT, of course, is your default now. It's the first thing you do. And the reason you see me say maybe is because we've seen so many places where ChatGPT is very good at the first order answer. Just as an example, what is the best plan for me given my sort of high level data, right? Early stage breast cancer, HER2 positive. At the highest level, great. But the thing about medicine today and oncology specifically is we've gotten so personalized. We're no longer just in what's the best plan for me as a patient with HER2 positive breast cancer. We're at the point of like, how much HER2? Is it 1, 2, or 3? Like HER2 low, HER2 high? Is it HER2 low with ER positive and PR positive or just ER positive? Is it HER2 low, ER positive with a high Ki-67 or a low Ki-67? Then we're in the world of somatic mutations that's layered on top of that. Then we're in the world of germline mutations. So I'm completely with you. I think at the first pass, ChatGPT is phenomenal. Very, very good at orientation for the first time. Maybe the second time, maybe even the third time. The fourth time around though, I think it taps out. And I think that's a function of time, I would imagine. I think if you look out 5 years from now, I think that shifts. I think what I said is probably true today, but may not be true a couple of years from now. So I do think it's going to continue to proliferate in that way. But at least as of today, GPT-4 is great for someone who knows what question to ask. But you need to know what question to ask.
You need to know what question to ask. But AI is learning at such a rate that the next question it'll ask you when you ask it a question is, I can't answer this question until you tell me these other things to give you precisely the information you need to get you personalized healthcare, which is what you want in the first place, personalized healthcare. And then on top of that, you layer genomics and you layer all the business of how do you interpret that data in order to get to the very drug that is going to turn off the very gene that's causing that very problem in these circumstances. But it's a matter of time before that happens. So where do you see all of this going? How is the business of healthcare going to have to pivot, and how quickly is it going to pivot? And where do you see the evidence for that?
I probably have a very dystopian view of healthcare. And I think what we just spoke about is on the technology side. But if I look at the systems that are being used today in healthcare, despite the advent of AI, we're still using technology from the 80s. So if I just look at technology being used as of 2023 in the hospital system, we're decades behind any other industry. So do I want healthcare to get to this new future? Absolutely. Do I believe it will get to this new future in the next 5 years? I don't think so. I think it all comes down to where are the pockets of money. And it goes back to your question of business, right? If I'm an insurer, my biggest place of AI innovation is probably cost optimization. If I'm a pharma company, it's probably drug discovery or enhancing R&D productivity. I do think AI is being used already and will continue to be used, but it depends on, is it going to be in places where it makes a meaningful difference to either the clinician or the patient today? And I suspect not for a while, because healthcare is a business. And from a business prioritization perspective, I think there are other places where you would apply technology like GPT-4.
I understand that we are, and I agree that we are using technology that we were using in the 1980s. It's almost to the point where people are still, in some places, still using fax machines. It's laughable.
I have one at home because I interact with the system so much. I'm not even joking. I got diagnosed, and one of the first three things I did was buy a fax machine. Because it's true. It's what we use. And if you need to get medical records out of the system, you need a fax machine. And a CD player, by the way. That's also still being used, which is, you know, ironical on so many levels, but that's okay.
Given that we can agree that healthcare is not going to change dramatically anytime soon, notwithstanding all of this in terms of technology and other innovations that are being brought to the fore. In fact, they say that healthcare know-how, knowledge is changing at a rate of complete change every 2 years. So what was taken for granted 2 years ago is no longer applied. So we are in a situation where it's almost impossible to keep up with the advances that science and technology are making to the potential. But while we wait for people to catch up, I want to talk about the experience and how that could be changed. So if we set aside our skepticism about the change, where do you think the experience could change today in a way that could make the experience a little bit better?
I think it goes back to providing tools for patients. So I think technology is one thing, right? But technology is not the same thing as a product. For me, a technology is an enabler of a product, but we still need a product that is facing the patient. And providing information is just one thing, right? Because information is only as good as contextualization of that information to a specific point in the patient experience. And if we're going to rely solely on the patient to come up with the question, ask the question, and get smart, I think that it will work to some extent, but I don't think it has the kind of transformative shift, at least I would hope to see on the patient experience side. So I do think we need basic tools that are designed for patients to meet them where they are. And we say that, what I just said is sort of a lot of language that's used in the world of design and healthcare. You have to meet the patient where they are, unmet needs. There's a lot of use of that language and that phrase, but what I'm talking about is actually doing that, right? Like let's just take your average cancer patient, right? 50% of cancer patients are above 70. And if you look at tools today out there, most tools go digital first, which makes no sense to me. It's not that patients above 70 are not digital users, they're just not digital native users. And that's fine. So why aren't we designing tools that give them and meet them where they are? Like, why aren't we designing better paper tools? Just as an example, right? I'm using that as one small example. If you're talking about a population where you have huge amounts of diversity on literacy, diversity on language, diversity on communication, diversity on cultural backgrounds, diversity on preferences, we don't design products to keep that in mind. So I think it is about designing tools and systems facing the patient, acknowledging that they actually have a role that is more than the recipient of care. Because I think patients are seen as recipients of care versus actually partaking in decision-making for their care. So I do think there's a perspective shift that needs to happen. But if we were to have that perspective shift, that they're not just recipients, they're actively participating in both decision-making and managing care, I think what we end up designing shifts.
The Journal of Health Design, fostering collaboration, amplifying the voice of health advocates, growing a network to improve outcomes in healthcare.
We need tools that are fit for purpose, and they currently are not. And you're right, for non-native digital tool users, it's very difficult to get where you want to be. In the midst of all of this, you have another player which hasn't received any attention in our conversation, and that is the healthcare practitioner themselves. They are aware of both challenges. On the one hand, the patient with the needs that are not currently being met, don't necessarily ask the right question. On the other hand, the system, which is designed like a 1970s factory, essentially just churning out cookie cutter solutions for people. There you are sitting in that chair. How do we assist that practitioner, whatever their pedigree, to do a better job?
So I think for me, that sits in probably three categories. So I should probably give a bit of background on this. My master's thesis was in clinician burnout. So I had, and this was before my experiences as a cancer patient, this was before any of that happened. So I ended up spending about 600 hours interviewing clinicians from across the US. And I say that because I truly have a lot of empathy for clinicians who are practicing medicine today. And I don't just mean oncologists, I don't just mean MDs, I'm talking nurses, MAs, APPs, like, that entire system is just not designed to enable that practitioner to do just about anything. And I think the reason I said that three categories, the obvious answer here is fix the EMR. That's their low-hanging fruit, obvious answer. That entire system needs to get rehauled. I think that's what anybody who looks at the space, it's kind of the most obvious place to go. I do think there's an and in that, though. And the and is, if I look at medical education in the US, a lot of it is focused on biology, which makes perfect sense. It's, again, you need to do that. But I think there are two areas where I suspect that the medical education system actually needs to shift. And the first is on interpersonal dynamics. Because what's happening today is patients are shifting, right? You have rapid progression of technology availability, rapid democratization of information. So your patients are completely shifted. But the oncologists, and I'm oncologists just for our conversation, or HCPs, are working in really ancient systems. So there is a big delta between mindset and perspective between a patient and a clinician. And what happens is the patient's walking in holding an iPhone, a MacBook, pick your flavor of Apple product, and then you're entering a system which is just ancient. So there is a huge amount of dissonance that happens as a patient. And I think clinicians need to have training to be able to acknowledge that upfront, because what happens is it's not acknowledged. So there's this underlying dissonance that happens between the patient and physician experience all the time. So there is that interpersonal relationship portion of it. And the second is actually honestly mostly a Samira pet peeve, is more math and statistical training. And I say that because, especially in oncology, if we look at the shift in medical education, medical information that's happening, most of it is grounded in statistical studies, right? Clinical trials are pretty much only stats. And the number of times I've had to, like, I've just had massively dissonant moments with clinicians where they are trying to convince me to get on a treatment because they're quoting a relative risk. I looked at the data and I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. Relative risk, yes, you're right, 50% improvement. However, absolute risk is 2%. Like, what are we talking about? So there is this moment of decision-making science, statistics, that I really wish our clinicians could actually participate in decision-making that was grounded a little bit better in the actual data versus spouting guidelines because we have guidelines, right? So I think there is that balance there that I personally, and this is a personal pet peeve of mine versus a system-wide thing, but I really wish clinicians could do more of that.
Interpersonal skills, the ability to communicate effectively at a time when somebody is triggered by an experience and their amygdala is essentially not allowing that information to get to the neocortex to make rational decisions. How do you get that happening? And I also agree with you, because I've seen this repeatedly, that relative risk is quoted all the time. Relative risk reduction is quoted all the time. Absolute risk reduction is hardly ever mentioned. You say, well, actually, the benefit from this is tiny, tiny, for a major change, a radical change in the way that I would be living my life or taking the treatment or whatever it happens to be. So you're right on both counts. Some final thoughts, Samira. We've covered a huge amount of ground. Where to from here for all of us?
I can tell you what my personal goals are, because I think as a system, there's a lot of things that need to shift. And while I have a dystopian view, I also believe that people are well-intentioned and want to do right and want to fix the system. And there's tons of people out there trying to do better. So I can tell you what my personal goals are, which is I really do believe in building for the patients. And it's not just because I was a patient. It's because I was told consistently that I'm the outlier patient for the better part of the last 3 years. Samira, you're the outlier. You know, you're more educated, more activated, more engaged than the average patient. And I have now met thousands and thousands of cancer patients. And at some point, sampling bias, it just doesn't, it doesn't account for the number of stories I hear. It just doesn't. And I have met so many patients and so many family members who advocate for themselves, push back on the system, push back on oncologists, respect them, but push back, who want different things around their plate to navigate cancer, who want better tools, who expect better, that I at least would like to dedicate the next chapter of my life to that cause.
You were billed as a wonderful guest for the podcast. You've been thoughtful, insightful, and in fact, you do speak for all of us, clinicians, patients alike. I think that the ideas that you have shared with us have huge resonance, and for that, I thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Health Design Podcast, serving patient and physician advocates. Visit us at journalofhealthdesign.com.